This show was first broadcast on Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. For more information on Fresh FM, as well as links to other great locally produced programs, go to our website, freshfm.net.
Hello and welcome. I'm Galen Pound, and you're listening to Top Writers. In a few moments, I'll be talking to Nelson author Emily Larkin about her historical romances, which are hugely popular all around the world. But first, we're going to hear from Dana.
This is Dana Wensley, and you're listening to Top Writers. I'm the Freedom of Speech spokesperson for PEN in New Zealand. PEN is a worldwide organisation that promotes literature and freedom of expression. For the last week, I've been wondering what to say about the fact that Lauren Southern, an alt-right speaker, was recently banned from using an Auckland council-owned venue to spread her views. One of the principles that PEN stands by is the principle that freedom of speech is to be construed widely. If you believe in freedom of speech, you believe in it not just for those views you agree with, but for all views. Given that fact, you would expect me to come out swinging in defence of the right of Lauren Southern to speak in New Zealand. Even though I don't agree with Lauren Southern's views, being committed to freedom of speech, I should fight tooth and nail to defend her right to state her views. In her book, Barbarians, How Baby Boomers, Immigrants and Islam Screwed My Generation, Lauren Southern stated, "Diversity is not a strength. It's a weakness. Its legacy is not peace and love, but division and hate. It is to civilizations what autoimmune disorders are to the human body. It must be raised, salted and burned." I find this view repulsive, historically incorrect and morally corrupt, but as a freedom of speech spokesperson, I should defend her right to say it. That is what good advocates of freedom of speech do. But here's the thing, I'm not going to. I know I will get emails about this, but I find the rally of concern around the plight of Lauren Southern objectionable, and in some cases I suspect her supporters are likely motivated more from a hidden political agenda than a real concern for free speech. Here's why. I'm going to put the whole Lauren Southern free speech debate in perspective. Lauren Southern, whose views can be readily accessed on Facebook and books bought on Amazon, is denied to speak at an Auckland council-owned venue and an army of academics, ex-politicians and other concerned citizens, calling themselves the Free Speech Coalition, passes the hat around and raises $50,000 within a few days to bring a court action to review the council decision. Let's weigh this up against the fact that in the first 6 months of 2018, 47 writers alone have been killed, made up of 36 professional journalists, 9 citizen journalists and 2 media workers. Where were the white knights of free speech then? I do not see Paul Moon, Don Brash or Chris Trotter, all members of Free Speech Coalition, opening their checkbooks to help the cause of free speech in this instance. What about when the Mexican journalist Veronica Villalso, who specialises in investigating, exposing and raising awareness of femicide in Mexico, gets subjected to constant threats, some of which detail how they will throw her corpse onto a garbage dump so dogs can eat it if she keeps reporting. Others explain in detail how they'd rape her if she continues on her investigations. Femicide is a big issue in Mexico. It is reported that 5,118 women have been murdered in the last 2 years, an average of 7 homicides per day, according to a report by the UN's Gender Equality Observatory for the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean. Mexico continues to be the most dangerous country for a writer or journalist, according to PEN's latest statistics. If the Free Speech Coalition is so concerned with free speech, I would accept that they will be ready to raise millions to support PEN and other groups who actually support writers around the world who are imprisoned or killed or discriminated against because of their work. If that is too much to expect, what about a boycott of Mexican products? Even one little letter to the paper about it? An opinion piece? Anything? But no, the silence has been deafening. Maybe, I hear you say, it is just that it is in our human nature to only care about what happens on our soil. Maybe this is why the Free Speech Coalition will raise $50,000 to support some right-wing speakers who are denied a council venue and not speak out when free speech is denied elsewhere in the world. To which I would reply, why were these same voices that are so quick to come to the defence of the alt-right speakers silent in the wake of the unlawful search in the home of author and journalist Nikki Hager relating to his book Hit and Run? Why also were these voices silent when Rolf and Uta Klein's home in Golden Bay was illegally searched in the wake of the 1080 poisoned milk powder saga? All they had done was write submissions over the use of 1080 and written letters to news organisations. I think this is not about free speech at all. I think this rally of support for Lauren Southern is about politics. Free speech is being used as a political tool. That is not surprising. The term free speech is often bandied about with little thought as to what it means. As a freedom of speech spokesperson for PEN in New Zealand, I've been covering issues of free speech for a number of years. During this time, I've observed that when someone from the far right is prevented from exercising their right to free speech, there is a public outcry, but when other voices are suppressed, we neither seem to notice or care. Can I justify this assertion? Yes. It was just last year that Paul Moon and others wrote an open letter warning of a forceful silencing of dissenting or unpopular views following the closing down of the group European Students Association at Auckland University. This was a group which was established with imagery and slogans which echoed white supremacist groups. It was exposed to credible threats of violence, causing the university to withdraw its application of affiliation with the Auckland University Students Association. The open letter was an impressive response, alleging that free speech was in jeopardy. But what was less impressive was the lack of awareness that the alt-right exercises a double standard when it comes to free speech. Free speech does not condone violence, but neither does it guarantee the right to espouse racist or sexist views without being forced to justify and defend your stance. You cannot shoot from the hip one moment and then complain when you are gunned down in the crossfire the next. There was a tendency, particularly by the alt-right, to confuse freedom of speech with the freedom not to be challenged by your speech. What the alt-right alleges is that they are no longer free to speak out without fear of social repercussions. In this case, the real concern by Auckland Live that there would be a significant health and safety implication if the speech by Lauren Southern went ahead was the social repercussions that had to be taken into account. In this case, it was Auckland Live's decision whether this event would go ahead at the venue. This was their call to make. Yes, free speech must be kept alive. It must be safeguarded, and we need to be constantly vigilant. But in following the controversy about Lauren Southern and other right-wing speakers, I'm left with the following conclusion. It has been said, when you're accustomed to privilege, equality can feel a lot like oppression. Meaning this, if we continue to only come to the aid of those on the far right when there is a threat to freedom of speech, we risk sending the message that we only care about their views. I'm sure this is not the intention of Paul Moon and others, but the Free Speech Coalition should remember that sometimes free speech is important for the quiet voices as well. It would be nice to see the Free Speech Coalition supporting those who report from the margins, those who are imprisoned or abused or killed for their writing and views. To speak out in defence of free speech only when it is the far right whose voices are being suppressed makes free speech a political tool, not a human rights one. If you want to find out more about what PEN does and how you can be involved, follow the links on the New Zealand Society of Authors website to PEN, or contact me, Dana Wensley, at pen@nzauthors.org.nz.
I'm Galen Pound, and you're listening to Top Writers. My guest today is historical romance writer Emily Larkin. Welcome to Top Writers, Emily.
Thank you, Galen.
Your historical romances are all set in the Regency period. Could you please tell us a little about this short but very pivotal time in history and why you're so fascinated with it?
Well, if you're going to be strict about it, the Regency period was from 1811 to 1820, which is when the Prince Regent was ruling England. But more broadly speaking, the period covers from the late 1790s to 1820. And it's the time of the French Revolution, it's the time of Napoleon, it's the time of the Battle of Waterloo. It's also when Jane Austen was writing and publishing. So Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, Emma, all of those novels. And I think that's probably the easiest way to define it as Jane Austen's time. Now, the reason why I love the period is because I grew up reading Georgette Heyer. And I think the first book I read of hers was The Masqueraders, which was one of my father's favourites when he was a boy. And The Masqueraders has a brother and a sister who are pretending to be a sister and a brother, which is exactly what it sounds like. The girl is pretending to be a boy and the boy is pretending to be a girl. Well, they're growing up. The woman is pretending to be a man. And that one takes place just a bit before the Regency, but most of Heyer's books are actually set during the Regency. And you can argue that Georgette Heyer actually created the Regency romance genre. Because when you think about it, Jane Austen was actually writing contemporary romance. Georgette Heyer is the one who basically established the Regency romance genre. And one of her hallmarks was there's always comedy in her books. So you'll find a lot of comedy in, or a lot of humour in Regency romances.
Right, now reading some of your books, it was the small details that really brought the stories alive for me, like the tallow candles that smelt like mutton, calf skin diaries, and the smell of camphor, lavender and beeswax surrounding a deathbed. Apart from reading Georgette Heyer, how did you go about finding all those small but really important details?
Well, I was going to say that Georgette Heyer is quite pivotal with that because you soak that kind of stuff up. If you read Georgette Heyer, if you read Jane Austen, a lot of Dickens as well. I mean, he was mainly writing during Victorian times, but he was born during the Regency and he did set books during the Regency. Then a lot of it's imagination and a lot of it is research. I have quite a large research library and I also do a lot of research on the internet.
Right, because it was the whole things like the tallow candles for the servants and the beeswax for the upper class. Now, have you ever got a detail wrong?
Yes, I have got details wrong. For example, I had a character obtain a special license from the Bishop of Exeter because I had read in a source that all bishops could give special licences, but it's actually only Archbishop of Canterbury who could do that. So that was a mistake, but it's not one that I'm too concerned about because most readers wouldn't know that only the Archbishop of Canterbury could issue marriage licences, special marriage licences. The really big mistake that I have made and that fortunately was caught before publication is that I wrote a book about a duke, and in the book I called him Lord, like Lord so-and-so and my lord, and dukes are never lords. Earls are lords, and marquesses are lords, and viscounts are lords, but dukes are never lords. So yeah, that would be my biggest mistake, and I'm never, ever, ever going to repeat that one.
Because the thing is, there's always one person out there, and they are the one that hits social media and...
Yeah.
Now, the Baleful Godmother series and its prequel, The Fay Quartet, all contain elements of magic. Could you please tell us a little about people's belief in magic during the Regency period?
Okay, so my take on this is that I think that basically they felt the same way about magic that we do today, which means that they didn't really believe it existed, which is why my characters are always so shocked and disbelieving when they're confronted by it. However, there was a woman, I think her name was Mary Bateman, and she was hanged in England in 1809 for witchcraft. And also during the Regency, you're just getting into the beginning of, it hasn't quite hit, but the whole seance, that was a very Victorian thing. But so you're almost getting into the seances and you are having people hanged for witchcraft. So yeah, it's a difficult question to answer because I don't think they believed in magic, but obviously it, on some level they believed in magic more than we do.
And it's a hard one because people say they don't believe in magic, yet they'll go and see Dynamo, who's appearing in Auckland coming up very, very soon. It's like what you want to believe in for your own self-justification, really, isn't it? Now, how people spoke in those days is so different to how we do today, or even how we spoke 20, 30 years ago. How did you go about making the way the characters speak sound authentic?
So I try very hard to use language that is particular to that era, but I also want to make the people sound like real people. So I want it to be natural and not stilted. So I use contractions and all that sort of thing. My heroes do also swear quite badly at times, but only among other men, never in front of a woman. I've got a number of books on Regency slang, and I use different types of slang in my books. For example, the sorts of slang that an elegant lady might use as opposed to vulgar slang that you'd hear when the characters go into the slums. For a lady, some slang would be like to pluck a rose, which meant to go to the bathroom, or to fly up into the boughs, which meant to become cross. That's slang. Well, I classify that as slang. Whereas for a man, it would be to shoot the cat or cast up your accounts. That means you're going to vomit or you have vomited. And there's also a lot of scatological, anatomical and sexual slang that's particular to that period, which I try to use when it's appropriate.
Right. Now, what are you going to read for us today?
So I've got an excerpt that's from my latest book, which comes out in a few weeks' time. Now, the hero, Oliver, is a career soldier who has just become a duke because his uncle and his two cousins unexpectedly died. So that's the setup. And the only thing you need to know about this excerpt is that a postchaise is a carriage that was used for rapid travel. It was barely midnight, early by London standards. Oliver strolled along St. James Street. At Piccadilly, he waited for a hackney to pass, and then a town carriage with a nobleman's crest on it. A postchaise swept into view, travelling slightly too fast, the four horses sweating, the postillions dusty and eager to reach their journey's end. Oliver waited for it to pass, too, and as he waited, someone shoved him violently between the shoulder blades. Oliver tumbled headfirst into the street, right in the path of the postchaise. He fell heavily, rolled, one of the leaders stepped on him, and then the horses passed over him in a clatter of iron-shod hooves and loud jangle of harnesses, and the bulk of the carriage blotted everything out. Oliver curled up into as small a ball as he could, aware of huge wheels scything past. Something brushed his wrist, plucking at his cuff, and then it was over. He uncurled himself and scrambled for the pavement on hands and knees, dimly aware of shouts and cries of alarm. Oliver didn't try to stand. He stayed on his hands and knees for a moment, gulping for breath. There was thunder in his ears, the thunder of hooves and carriage wheels, the thunder of his heartbeat. Voices jabbered at him. It took a moment for the words to make sense. "Sir, are you all right, sir?" Oliver lurched upright, staggered, and caught his balance. "I'm fine," he said, "fine." But he wasn't. He was shaking, and he couldn't quite seem to catch his breath. He looked for the postchaise. It had halted, the horses snorting and tossing their heads, the postillions white-faced, craning their necks to look back, probably fearing they'd killed him. They very nearly had killed him. Half a dozen people were clustered around him, wide-eyed and excited. He didn't recognise any of them. "Did you see who pushed me?" Oliver asked. His audience gaped at him. "Push you?" said a man who looked like a lawyer's clerk. "Ain't no one has pushed you." Oliver knew damned well that someone had pushed him. "Did you see anyone running away?" The little crowd began to melt into the shadows, people stepping back, turning from him, moving off into the dark. Did they think he was going to accuse one of them of trying to kill him? One man didn't turn away, a crossing sweeper. He held out an object. "Your hat, Governor." Oliver's hat didn't look like a hat anymore. It had almost been cut in two by the carriage wheels. He took it and turned it slowly over in his hand. It could have been his arm crushed this flat. It could have been his neck. He looked around, scanning the street, scanning the shadows. His audience was gone. The postchaise was gone. He saw nothing out of the ordinary. No one loitering. No one watching.
Thank you. And the name of that book is?
That one's called Primrose and the Dreadful Duke, because Oliver has a dreadful sense of humour.
And it's due out later this year.
And this month, yes.
This month.
Due out at
Yay.
The end of this month.
Right, now your Baleful Godmother series doesn't restrict itself to heterosexual relationships. And unmasking Miss Appleby, Charlotte isn't just dressed as a man, but actually becomes a man in parts of the book. and Claiming Mr. Kemp tells the story of Tom and Lucas's homosexual relationship. Could you please tell us about your decision to go down that path with your characters?
Okay, so it was actually two different decisions. For Charlotte's book, I really wanted to have some fun with the woman pretending to be a man trope. And it's a trope that many writers have explored, but I don't generally find it particularly believable. And the exception to that is Georgette Heyer, who did it very well in some of her books. So for Unmasking Miss Appleby, I decided to have my heroine not just dress as a man, but literally become a man for a while. And it was a huge amount of fun because she was completely clueless about so many different things. With Tom and Lucas's book, I really wanted to try writing a male-male romance. Incidentally, it's a growing subgenre of romance. When I wrote Tom and Lucas's story, as a reader and a writer, I'm very hero-centric. And by that I mean that while I identify with the heroine and like the heroine, it's the hero whom I become emotionally engaged with. And I loved writing Tom and Lucas's story because I had two heroes. And they're actually two of my all-time favourite heroes, Tom because of his sense of humour, and Lucas because he's the first virgin hero I've ever written, which was a lot of fun as well. And in addition to having two heroes in that book, it also came with an added level of conflict because at that time, homosexuality was punishable by flogging or imprisonment or hanging. So it made their relationship quite fraught and it added a layer of tension to their relationship.
I must say, out of your books that I've read, it was that book, Claiming Mr. Kemp, that was my favourite.
Yeah, it's my favourite in that series as well.
Now, The Midnight Quill Trio, a review of that said the stories feel connected but not repetitive. Do you make a conscious effort to avoid falling into that trap?
Yeah, I do. I make an effort to make every story different from the others. And I find this particularly challenging with the sex scenes. So I try very hard to make them different from each other. And when I look back over the last dozen books I've written, I feel quite happy that I've managed to separate the sex scenes or differentiate the sex scenes. And in fact, the sex scene in this current book, Primrose and the Dreadful Duke, is the most comic one I've ever written. And I'm hoping that there is a point in the middle of the scene where readers will laugh out loud.
Now, you're exceptionally busy because it's taken over a year to actually get you in to the studio to record this interview. How many books a year do you write?
I aim for 3 to 4 a year. This year it's only going to be 3. And I am actually trying to teach myself how to use dictation to write because I need to, or I wish to, become faster.
Right, now romance books far outsell any other genre. According to bookstr.com, romance books are sitting on sales of $1.44 billion. And then in second place, we've got crime and mystery books, whose sales amount to $728.2 million. What do you think's the appeal of romance books?
I think it's quite simple. I think the appeal is a happy ending. I think that is the big thing for most readers, is a happy, satisfying ending. The books are entertaining, they're an escape from daily life, they're fun, and that, I think, is what all genre fiction is aiming for. And I think the other thing that romances do really well is that they portray positive, healthy relationships between people.
Great. Now, the song you've chosen today is 500 Miles by The Proclaimers. Why?
Oh, I really love this song. I love the beat because it makes me want to move. I love the Scottish accent. And if you listen to the words, it's actually deeply romantic.
Right, let's listen to 500 Miles by The Proclaimers.
When I wake up, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who wakes up next to you. When I go out, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who goes along with you. If I get drunk, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who gets drunk next to you. And if I haver, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who's havering to you. But I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more just to be the man who walked 1,000 miles to fall down at your door. But I'm watching, yes, I know I'm gonna be
I'm gonna be the man who's working hard for you. When the money comes in for the work I do, I'll pass almost every penny on to you. When I come home, oh, I know I'm gonna be the man who comes back home to you. And if I broke, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who's growing older than you. But I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more just to be a man who walks 1,000 miles to fall down at your door. I'm gonna be the man who's lonely without you. And when I'm dreaming, well, I know I'm gonna dream about the time when I'm with you. When I go out, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who goes along with you. And when I come home, yes, I know I'm gonna be the man who comes back home with you. I'm gonna be the man who's coming home.
Much, Emily, for taking time out of your hectic schedule to be with us today. To find out more about Emily and her historical romances, go to emilylarkin.com. And Emily also writes fantasy books as Emily G. For information on those, you can go to emilyg.com. I'm Galen Pound, and you've been listening to Top Writers. A podcast of this program and upcoming events can be found on www.topwriters.co.nz.
Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this podcast available by funding the Access Internet Radio Project. Other great programs from Fresh FM are available through iTunes, the Stitcher app, the TuneIn Radio app, and our website, freshfm.net.